from KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. LASIK surgery has helped millions of people see better, but it's not for everyone and some have complications. The pros and cons of LASIK today on Insight. You'll meet several eye care professionals, including a top local provider of LASIK surgery and an optometrist who prefers alternatives to surgery. We'll also talk with patients. And activist, poet, and author Luis Rodriguez, he's best known for the memoir Always Running, about his days as a gang member in East LA. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, writer Luis J. Rodriguez was once a gang member in Los Angeles. Now he's an activist working with young people both in school and behind bars. He's in Sacramento for a talk tonight. First, you'll meet him on Insight. It seems like fewer people wear glasses nowadays, and LASIK eye surgery is surely one of the reasons. Last year alone, an estimated 1.3 million LASIK procedures were performed in the U.S. Most people who undergo LASIK surgery don't need to wear glasses afterwards. But it's not for everyone, and there are people who've undergone LASIK and suffered problems. We're going to look at the pros and cons of LASIK today. We'll start with a satisfied former patient. She's Ursula Reed. Ursula, welcome to Insight.
Hello.
How was your vision before you had LASIK surgery?
Oh, I couldn't see very much for long distance at all, and had to either wear contacts or glasses. Couldn't manage without either one.
Yes. And why did you decide to get LASIK?
I've been thinking about it for several years and just couldn't afford the time to invest into doing it, or I thought I couldn't. And after having had it done and gone through the whole process, I don't understand why I waited so long.
Well, why did you wait so long?
Time, I think. I just couldn't find the right time to stop wearing contact lenses. And things were happening. I was traveling a little bit and could never find the right time, I suppose.
Was cost and or concern about what it involved and what could happen afterwards, were those factors?
Actually, what could happen afterwards was a factor. Cost, not so much, because if it was successful, you know, whatever I would pay, it wouldn't matter to me. But as far as what would happen after I'd had it done, yes, I was concerned about that.
What do you remember of the procedure?
It was absolutely wonderful. The staff at Griffin and Reed were absolutely perfect, and they talked you through the whole procedure and let you know if there was going to be something that you would experience that you wouldn't normally experience, and prepared you for everything.
And what did you experience?
Just when they were actually doing the surgery, they told me that when they actually used the laser on me, that my vision would go black. And if I hadn't have known that prior to the surgery, I would have panicked. And it's important to keep still. And they talked me through that. I expected it. It happened. And it was so quick. The surgery went in the blink of an eye, if you'd like.
Can you tell us what it looked like when it was actually being done?
Well, I didn't really... What do you mean? The actual equipment or...
Well, the actual procedure when the laser is being used.
Well, you don't really look at anything. You just look straight ahead and you see a light. You have to focus on the light. And I didn't think that I would be able to focus on it without blinking. But they give you some eye drops that keep your eyes open. And I only had one eye done, actually, in the end. But it turned out perfect. I was so comfortable having it done.
Did you have any complications?
No, I didn't. None whatsoever. I followed the guidelines. I followed the medications. I did everything as they prescribed, and it was perfect. And I just thank God that I had it done, and thanks to Dr. Reed.
How's your vision now?
I never have to pick up glasses. I never have to pick up contact lenses. As far as I'm concerned, it's perfect. I had a 20/20 vision when I went in for my eye check afterwards.
Sounds like you'd probably do it again.
I would. In fact, I'm trying to get my husband to do it right now. So.
And when did you have this done?
I had it done in April.
Okay. So just a few months ago. Have you noticed any subsequent changes in your eyes or your vision?
No, none whatsoever. Just the usual. If you work on the computer for a long time, they become a little bit tired. But as far as distance and everything else, even my night vision is really good. And I did have glasses prepared for my left eye because I had the monovision situation. I don't even have to wear those at night time because my right eye, the one that I had surgery on, is strong enough to get me through night driving.
Ursula, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome. I highly recommend the surgery to anybody that thinks about having it done.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
That's Ursula Reed. Had LASIK surgery a few months ago, was satisfied with it. By the way, she's no relation to the Reed of Griffin and Reed Eye Care that she referred to. In our studio is Glenn Hagley, who's Executive Director and founder of the Council for Refractive Surgery Quality Assurance, a non-profit group that usually goes by the name USA Eyes and which advocates for LASIK patients. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here.
What is LASIK surgery?
LASIK surgery actually is a two-step process. Initially, a flap of corneal tissue, the cornea is the clear front of your eye, is created and moved out of the way. A specialized laser then applies laser energy to the exposed cornea, and that laser energy ablates tissue or removes tissue, reshaping the cornea. After the laser is through, the LASIK flap is repositioned, and the patient's recovery starts.
Is there any pain or heat or bright light associated with the process? We did talk to Ursula, but I just want to find out if her experience is typical.
There's no heat. The laser is not using heat. It actually causes a chemical reaction of the bonds that hold the cells together, so they literally fly away. There's usually no pain, and part of the reason there's no pain is that LASIK flap. It was found that if the laser energy is applied on the surface of the cornea, you get a full wound response, which usually indicates pain and swelling. But if the laser energy was applied deeper into the cornea, it somewhat fools the eye that it doesn't know it's had surgery. So you don't get the wound response. Vision recovery usually is very quick, and it's usually without pain.
Have you had LASIK surgery?
Now, I chose to have a surface ablation technique called PRK, or photorefractive keratectomy.
What's that?
That's LASIK without the flap.
How much does LASIK surgery cost typically around these parts?
Well, there's a wide range. You will see advertisements sometimes as low as $299 per eye. And the actual national average is closer to $1,650 to $1,850 per eye. Now, when you look at the fine print of those very discounted prices, you will see there are a lot of restrictions. You have to have very little need for correction. You will need to use older technology, and a lot of people will not qualify. I'm sure there are some people out there that will qualify for the discount price, but they're going to be rare. One of the national chains that commonly advertises $299 to $499 is publicly traded, so we know that their actual average is about $1,250 per eye.
Well, that's a bit of a difference.
It's a significant difference, and some people would accuse this of bait and switch.
Would you accuse it of that?
No, because a person who qualifies under their very, very narrow parameters would get that price. It's just the reality is that very few people will qualify for a low price.
What's the upper end? And is there any reason to go beyond that average price that you mentioned?
The upper end is about $2,500 to $3,000 per eye. And that would be probably a very different environment than you would find at $499. Is there a reason? Well, at some point, you're paying for expensive luggage. And it's not to say that the discount places don't have good results. They do. But the difference is sometimes the technology, the quality of the surgeon that you're using, the staff, and a lot of it is what I call the manner and means. to be able to be profitable at $4.99 an eye, they're going to need to do a lot of volume. You're going to have a lot of allied personnel that will be doing the preoperative and the postoperative care. You may not even see the surgeon until you go in and under the laser. Some people don't like that.
Who regulates this?
All the physicians who provide LASIK surgery are medical doctors. They're licensed by the state medical boards.
Glenn Hagley of the Council for Refractive Surgery Quality Assurance in Sacramento. On the phone is Barbara Burney, who is another person who's had LASIK eye surgery, and but not as successful as our first person. Barbara, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
How was your vision before you had LASIK surgery?
I was a very high myope with significant astigmatism, but was correctable perfectly with glasses. Very thick glasses, but I was correctable.
Okay, so your eyesight was not very good, but you were able to see with glasses.
Perfectly.
Why did you decide to get LASIK?
I had reached that age when my arms were no longer long enough, and I could not get a pair of bifocal glasses that would allow me to read.
Okay.
I was told that if I had LASIK, it would correct my distance vision, and I would just need reading glasses to be able to read.
Okay, well, what happened?
Not what I was promised. My vision now is heavily aberrated. I wear glasses all the time. I have 8 different pair of glasses I use right now. My cornea is very unstable. I have extreme dry eye. And my vision is just not functional after dark. I have no night vision at all.
Barbara Burney, by the way, is joining us from Rockford, Illinois. She's also president of Vision Surgery Rehab Network. It's an advocacy group for people that it describes as, quote, vision surgery casualties. Do you know that it was the LASIK surgery that caused your problems?
Absolutely. I have been told by several very prominent surgeons that I was not a good candidate, that they can't believe it, that what happened to me. And they have all been very dismayed by my results. I've been called the poster child for bad LASIK.
So the problem here was that you were not a good candidate and probably should not have had LASIK surgery in the first place.
Well, that I was a marginal candidate. I was a very high myope. I had dry eye to begin with.
Yes.
And I had astigmatism and larger pupils as well, which can, in combination with those other things, make many problems.
Glenn Hagley, how common is Barbara's experience?
Barbara's experience is not exactly common, but it's not unknown either. I happen to work with Barbara's organization to help patients that have had poor refractive surgery outcomes. Barbara is a case that she was very nearsighted, and probably, she says marginal, she probably was not very good candidate at all. And what's unfortunate is that the recovery from a bad LASIK can oftentimes be very expensive, very difficult, and in some cases, unsuccessful. Now, our organization put together a quality standards advisory committee to determine how many people really do have bad outcomes, and they have looked at a lot of different studies. We also directly evaluate patient outcomes. We come to the conclusion that about 3% of people who have refractive surgery, and that's all types, that's LASIK, PRK, all the different types, and that's all different patients, have some sort of unresolved complication at 6 months post-op, with about 0.5% being very severe, similar to what Barbara has described.
Barbara, what would you say to someone who is a good candidate for LASIK? Would you say to them, yeah, it's okay, go ahead and have LASIK?
You're assuming a lot. From my point of view, because I talk to so many people all the time who've had bad surgery, and of course I only talk to the people basically who've had bad outcomes, I can't endorse it personally. If someone is considered a good candidate, I advise them to find the best surgeon that they possibly can, do as much research as possible, talk to that surgeon's patients, get, you know, testimonials, and proceed with caution. It's an individual choice, and by no means does everybody have the kind of experience I have. In fact, I, as Glenn said, I'm a rarity. However, okay. I am considered a success by my surgeon.
Okay, well, we don't have your surgeon, so we can't check in with your surgeon. But Barbara, thanks so much for joining us. That's Barbara Burney, president of Vision Surgery Rehab Network. Thanks, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Glenn, just quickly.
Something that Barbara brought up is that she's considered a success by her surgeon. This is a phenomenon that we run into. A lot of doctors use the Snellen 20-whatever test, that big E sign. And a lot of patients are able to squint a little bit and recognize black letters on a white background that are familiar objects in a controlled environment. But in the real world, their vision is very, very poor quality. A lot of times, what is a success, just like what is a complication, is a matter of perception. Barbara mentioned was her vision at night. This is one of the problems that some patients have, that when they get into low-light environments, when their pupils get large, the quality of their vision drops dramatically. So there are people who are unable to drive at night. In fact, one of the major LASIK malpractice lawsuits was a commercial airline pilot who no longer could fly because he couldn't see at night.
On the phone is Dr. Brent Reed, an ophthalmologist at Griffin and Reed Eye Care. It's a Sacramento clinic that offers LASIK surgery and other related surgeries. Dr. Reed, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
When a patient comes into your clinic asking about LASIK surgery, what's the first question you ask them?
What do they expect from the LASIK surgery? What is their hopes for the outcome? What's the motivation, reason for doing it?
And what do you need to hear from them if you're going to proceed with the LASIK surgery?
I need to hear that they have realistic expectations and that there's a perception among patients that LASIK surgery is nothing but drive-through surgery, that it's not real surgery. It has, you know, it's not a big deal. And that perception comes from the lowball advertising and the general outlook out there that the mills try to present, that this is just an easy walk in the park. If any surgery is significant surgery, and LASIK surgery is no different. So I need to know that that patient understands that they're contemplating an elective surgery and that it has real potential consequences, both positive and negative.
Is it difficult to perform?
No, actually, it's not difficult to perform if you've been well-trained and if you know what you're doing. One of the things that you need to know is you need to have the best equipment so that you don't put people at risk, either for their safety or for their outcome. And then you need to follow the protocol and be very compulsive about how you do it. Another thing that's critically important is you need to see patients and follow up, collect data, do statistical analysis on those outcomes so you can perform good surgery and get good outcomes for the patients that come see you.
Which kind of people would you say, after you've examined them and talked with them, which kind of people would you say, you know what, you shouldn't be here, you would not benefit from LASIK surgery, or you really shouldn't do it at all?
If their expectation is that they will throw away their glasses and never have to wear glasses ever again for anything from the time they're 20 years old until they're 75 or 80 years old, that's not realistic. There will be some changes that go on in the eye as people age that will cause them to need perhaps some reading glasses at some point, although we do something called monovision that accommodates most people's distance, intermediate, and near needs for most of their lifestyle. Unfortunately, you have three focal needs in life. You have distance, which needs to be accommodated with the dominant eye in most people. Intermediate, which is kind of like computer range, supermarket shelf, dashboard distance. And then you have the near vision tasks. And you can accomplish most of those things up to a certain stage in your life with two eyes. But as the lens in your eye stiffens, that really up close range begins to diminish as you get into your 60s and 70s.
How often do the results fade with time, or do they always fade with time?
They really don't. In most people, they're lasting, and they tend to be good, at least as far as we know, out about 19 years now the surgery's been done. So corneas heal fairly predictably. There's a small group of patients with high correction that tend to drift a little bit into a slightly higher correction mode as they get older. But that's a small percentage in most cases. So it's for most patients that have the LASIK surgery, they tend to be pretty stable over time.
You said that people shouldn't be looking to throw away their glasses forevermore. But I guess some people probably do throw away their glasses forevermore. How many, roughly, In your experience, how many people actually are fully cured, if that's the right
word? Unencumbered by eyewear or eyeglasses? Probably about 85-90% don't wear a correction for anything at all. A small percentage will wear them for night driving because if they do the monovision correction, where the one eye sees for distance, one for near, they do very well in the daytime, but sometimes they're a little bit challenged at night, and so they'll get a pair of night driving glasses, which is blank in the distance eye and brings the near vision eye up to see as the same as the distance eye. And that occasionally happens, maybe 5 to 10% of the time. And then occasionally people that read for a living like the effect. They can walk in a restaurant, read a menu without any glasses. They can see who's calling them on their cell phone. But if they're going to sit down and, for example, attorneys, CPAs, people that do data entry that work all day long up close, get fatigued when they try to do most of that task with one eye for most of the day. And they sometimes will get workstation glasses that allow them the convenience and the comfort of being able to use both eyes throughout the day. But those are the main circumstances when you see people wearing corrective lenses after laser surgery, at least in our hands.
Well, I know that you're in surgery today and very busy, so I appreciate you taking a few minutes to talk with us, Dr. Reed.
It's a pleasure. And do you have John Hagley there?
Yes,
Glenn,
I'm here,
yes,
doctor.
Glenn's here.
John, how are you?
It's Glenn, doctor, but that's okay.
Oh, it's Glenn,
okay.
I'm sorry.
I can handle the rejection.
I'm sorry, Glenn.
I'm very well, and how are you?
I'm good.
I am delighted that you started in talking with expectations. The most that anyone can expect from LASIK is the convenience of a reduced need for corrective lenses. And to achieve that convenience, they have to understand that there is a bit of risk there. You have a very good reputation in town. You had one of your patients on earlier. And what's really important for people to understand is that this isn't a drive-through procedure. There are a lot of considerations involved.
Boy, and I don't know who I was listening to earlier, but because I just got here, I came from surgery and listened to that patient, apparently someone who's had an untoward result. Absolutely, do your research. Patients should not go into this lightly. They need to research it until they're happy with it. It took me 6 years of research till I had mine done because I was looking for certain circumstances and certain things to be fulfilled before I did my surgery. Had my own done. And I think that there's no such thing as a gotta in elective surgery. You need to do your research and make sure everything is right before you proceed.
Well, again, thank you very much, Dr. Reed.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us on.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Dr. Brent Reed, ophthalmologist at Griffin and Reed Eye Care, a Sacramento clinic that offers LASIK. Also with us now, Dr. David Muris, who's an optometrist at the Sacramento Vision Care Optometric Center, which offers alternatives to surgery. Dr. Muris, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here.
What are the alternatives to surgery that you offer?
Well, the usually a combination, but often what we used to call it orthokeratology. Now, sometimes it's referred to as refractive corneal therapy. It's basically a special type of gas permeable contact lens that reshapes the cornea.
Say that again. What is it? It's a form of contact lens?
It is a special contact lens, gas permeable lens that reshapes the cornea. And then often, depending on the patient, especially lower people who wear weaker prescriptions, sometimes we can do eye exercises, and sometimes that will satisfy the patient. Often I'm going to do both, but again, it is so important to realize that every patient's an individual, and even if they have the same refractive error, they may or may not be good candidates for LASIK or for the special therapeutic contact lenses or eye exercises.
Do you offer these specifically as an alternative to LASIK?
I'm pretty conservative. Surgery and meds for me are not the first line that I would use. I would try to do it more holistically and less surgery, less meds, if possible. If not, that's always an option. We discuss, unlike a lot of places, most places discuss surgery, and that's pretty much it. That's probably not informed consent, meaning that there are the corneal therapy lenses, especially, are really good these days, and you can take a minus 4 myope, somebody who sees the big letter on the chart in a matter of days, they're seeing 20/40 or better, and often just wearing the lenses just at night. anyway, it's kind of exciting. I don't have to just have one little tool in my chest, so to speak.
You said that you prefer a holistic approach. I have not had LASIK surgery, but based on what I've heard so far, it sounds like a fairly straightforward procedure. Why is that less holistic than putting on a contact lens to reshape the cornea?
I'm talking about non-invasive. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. When we do LASIK surgery, we take off part of the eye. And the last ophthalmologist that you had on, it was a Dr. Reed, I believe.
Yes.
You remember what he said? 6 years before he decided personally to do LASIK surgery. And if you took a survey of all the eye doctors out there, optometrists and ophthalmologists, the grand majority of them have not had the surgery, even if they're candidates. I don't know what it is about us humans, but we're relatively conservative. For instance, still to this day, glasses are used by almost 80%. I think it's like 78% of the public. Part of the reason is glasses are over 700 years and they work. But for a lot of people, especially myopes, nearsighted people, one of the common things I hear from them, these are my eyes, doctor. I don't know if I really want to do this surgery, even though in my mind the surgery is relatively safe and relatively effective. It is still... it's still not really accepted by the grand majority of even the profession and their families when it comes to having it done on themselves. It is slowly and gradually changing.
How do we know that your techniques are effective?
Which ones are we talking about?
Well, the special contact lens that you mentioned and the exercises.
Yeah. How do you know? There are various research projects on the contact lenses, especially because the contact lenses are considered a medical device. Eye exercise is not a medical device, so the FDA doesn't get involved in that. But anyway, the studies that have been done on the therapeutic contact lenses, and by the way, that's been around, just so you know, since the 50s, okay? So there's been a lot of interest. I shouldn't say a lot of interest. There's been interest over the years, and especially within the last 5 or 10 years, because of some of the new breakthroughs in the ability to make certain types of lens. I don't know if you know it or not, but consider a person who is reasonably nearsighted, putting on in order to see well at all, even the big letter on the chart, being able to see clearly with just wearing a therapeutic contact lens at night after a few weeks. And we don't take off part of the eye. We just move the eye around. So from that point of view, for a lot of patients, that is very, very appealing because they always have the option to do surgery later. Once we take off part of the eye, we don't go putting it back on.
Okay, Glenn Hagley, your response?
Glenn, I'm sorry, who are you?
I'm the executive director of the Council for Refractive Surgery Quality Assurance. We're a nonprofit organization.
Are you an ophthalmologist yourself?
No, I'm not a physician. I'm not a doctor. I'm sort of a doctor. I have an honorary doctorate from the University of St. Moritz in London. Now, that's an unaccredited foreign honorary. I'm as much a doctor as Captain Crunch is a maritime genius. One of the things that you said is that the eye care participants in the eye care industry haven't had LASIK, and that actually is a little bit misleading. When compared to the public at large, ophthalmologists and optometrists have about 3 times the rate of refractive surgery as the public. Now,
and Glenn, excuse me, and that percentage still is relatively very low.
Absolutely, that is true.
In fact,
it is a minority.
That percentage would be under 25%.
But the implication that doctors are not doing it, I think, would be an inaccurate analysis of the actual data. Now, you had mentioned the orthokeratology, which has some good scientific study.
Excuse me just a second, Glenn.
Sure.
If 100 doctors and their families could have the procedure and roughly 20 or less choose it, we'll let the public decide.
Well, absolutely. And I'm the first to say that refractive surgery, LASIK, PRK, or any type is not for everyone. And I'm sure that that comes into play. A lot of people are not candidates for LASIK or not good candidates. Some people just don't like the idea of having surgery on their eye.
Absolutely.
And we certainly want to stand by those people who decide not to have it. But the implication that the industry doesn't accept it because they're not having it themselves, I think, is probably inaccurate.
My point there, Glenn, was not it was the conservative part of human beings in nature.
Okay, and we're going to have to move on here. Dr. David Muras, thanks so much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
Dr. David Muras is an optometrist at the Sacramento Vision Care Optometric Center, which offers alternatives to surgery. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, more on LASIK eye surgery. We'll be right back. Listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. We're talking about LASIK eye surgery. It's helped millions to see without glasses, but it's not for everyone, and a few have had complications. In our studio is Glenn Hagley, who's Executive Director of the Council for Refractive Surgery Quality Assurance. It's a nonprofit group that usually goes by the name USA Eyes and which advocates for LASIK patients. Glenn, if someone wants to figure out which doctor they're going to go to, what do you say?
Well, there's in fact, the reason this organization was started is because I found that there really weren't very many tools to help someone find their doctor. We have put some of those tools together at our website, usaeyes.org. We have a list of 50 tough questions for your LASIK doctor.
That's a lot of questions.
It is a lot of questions, but we are talking about microsurgery on your eyes. We're talking about the results of which you're going to live with, good or bad, for the rest of your life.
There's a link to that on our webpage, capradio.org/insight, links to most of our guests. Do you really actually suggest that people pose all 50 of the questions?
What we recommend, we actually have it set up so they can download it, and there's a copy to be sent to the potential doctor. We recommend they give it to the doctor in advance. And a lot of doctors have already downloaded this, and the questions that can be answered in general, such as how many procedures you've done or your educational background, are already ready for a lot of the patients.
What's the most important question?
That is difficult because it's which one is not important? We surprise some people. One of the questions is if the doctor has ever been convicted of a felony. Now, not a lot of doctors get asked that, but I think that it's something a patient would want to know.
Yes. On the phone is Dr. Robert Buffington, an optometrist at Buffington Eye Care in Sacramento. He does corrective eye surgery. Dr. Buffington, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
What do you think of LASIK surgery?
Well, it's like I didn't hear all the prior guests. I kind of tuned in a little late.
That's okay. You presumably have a position on LASIK yourself.
Well, LASIK certainly serves a very good purpose when it goes well. When it doesn't go well, it poses some very serious problems for the patients. And I think, like Dr. Muras was saying, and Dr. Reed, that you have to pick the doctor extremely carefully. Like I have on my desk some Dr. Ellis thing for LASIK for $495. Obviously, he's got some type of cattle operation going here, running through as fast as he can. And I think you have to really do your research very, very carefully and ask around, find out who's gotten good LASIK outcomes, and then go interview the doctor, talk to him, and you got to feel comfortable with the doctor that you pick.
What should you do if you get a LASIK procedure and you're not happy with it, either because there's something not quite right or it's really not good, something bad has happened?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In some of the lawsuits I've been involved in and some of the poor outcomes that I see, there's one thing in common of all of them, and that's the doctor picked the wrong patient, whether it's the pupils are too large, the cornea is too thin, the patient had the wrong thinking of the outcome. When the surgery goes bad, it absolutely devastates the patient. And, for example, I had one here a couple of months ago where they operated on both eyes, cut both corneas too thin. We had what's called secondary ectasia, or both corneas bulged back out, and she's legally blind. And when you read her deposition, you realize that she's on Paxil because it's affected her nerves. She's on stomach medication. Goes into great detail how it's affected her sex life with her husband. So you have this whole cascade of events that happens if the surgery goes bad. And what you want to remember is that eyesight is the dominant sense in primates, like the dominant sense in dogs is smell and rabbits is hearing. So in humans, if you mess up the cornea, it's going to have a whole cascade of events that affects their entire life.
Would you recommend that someone go back to the same doctor to get it corrected?
Well, a lot of times, if you've cut a cornea too thin, you can't correct it. You've already taken the tissue away. So we have to find alternative ways to get these people to see. When you think about a cornea through evolution is, if you did a topography map, like the maps you'd use up in the Sierras to find your way around, if you run a topographical map of a human cornea, you'll see that it's, in general, steeper in the center, and it goes flatter as you go out. So it's an aspheric surface, not a spherical surface. So when you put a contact lens on a pre-surgical eye, it stays centered because it's steep in the center and has something to hang on to. Post-surgically, if we get a bad outcome, we now have a divot in the cornea, the opposite of having it steep. So it becomes very difficult in these patients that have no alternative to get a contact lens to center. So I have spent the last six, eight years developing different types of lenses that are actually flatter in the center, steeper on the edges, to try to get these lenses to center so these people can see. You can't give them a pair of glasses.
Yes.
You can't send them back and have it fixed. We're stuck.
Glenn Hagley, what do you suggest people do if they have, if they're not happy with the procedure, regardless of what
it is? First thing they need to do is to let their doctor know exactly what symptoms that they're having. A lot of times, refractive surgery like LASIK is more a six-month process than a 20-minute miracle. And a lot of times people have immediately postoperative some vision problems that they're concerned about. You need to let your doctor know about this. There also is a co-management system where you may have allied personnel, such as an optometrist, that is providing your postoperative care. If you think it's important, it may be necessary for you to go back to your surgeon to be evaluated again. We actually have a worldwide network of doctors who specialize in helping patients with bad refractive surgery outcomes. I'm delighted to say that Dr. Buffington, who you just spoke with, is one of those doctors. And we try to coordinate those resources so people who have had bad outcomes can get as good a vision as they can. Usually there's some success, sometimes there's not.
Okay. Well, we have to wrap this up, so I'm going to thank you both very much. On the phone, Dr. Robert Buffington of Buffington Eye Care in Sacramento, and in the studio, Glenn Hagley of the Council for Refractive Surgery Quality Assurance. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Delighted to be here.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, activist, poet, and author Luis Rodriguez. He's best known for the memoir Always Running, about his days as a gang member in East L.A. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Writer Luis J. Rodriguez was once a gang member in Los Angeles. He wrote a memoir of those times, a book called Always Running. Rodriguez also writes poetry, novels, and journalism. But he's also made a mark as an activist, particularly with artists and youth. Tonight, Luis Rodriguez speaks in Sacramento at an event for the Parent Teacher Home Visit Project. This afternoon, he's in our studio. Luis Rodriguez, welcome to Insight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I'd love to hear you read from Always Running. And we have an excerpt here from Chapter 1. Just tell us a little bit about what leads up to this excerpt before you read it.
Well, it was, I think, the idea that we were immigrants from Mexico. We were going from house to house, job to job, the sense of being migrants in an urban environment, and kind of laid the groundwork of not having so much instability, the sense of instability that can happen in this kind of world that some people fall into.
And you're at the railroad station. Okay.
Yeah, here we are. We pull into a parking lot at the Union Station. It's like a point of no return. My father's still making his stand. Mama looks exhausted. We continue to sit in our seats, quiet now, as Dad maneuvers into an empty space. Then we work our way out of the car, straightening our coats, gathering up boxes and taped over paper bags, our luggage. Up to this juncture, it's been like being in a storm. So much instability, of dreams achieved and then shattered. Of a silence within the walls of my body, of being turned on, beaten, belittled, and pushed aside, forgotten and unimportant. I have no position on the issue before us. To stay in L.A., to go, what does it matter? I've been a red-hot ball bouncing around from here to there. Anyone can bounce me. Mama, Dad, my brother, school, streets, I'm a ball, whatever. We are inside the vast cavern of the station. Pews of swirled wood are filled with people. We sit with our bags near us and string tied from the bags to our wrists so nobody can take them without taking us too. My father turns to us, says a faint goodbye, then begins to walk away. No hugs. He doesn't even look at us. Poncho, the name echoes through the waiting area. Poncho, he turns, stares at my mother. The wet of tears covers her face. Mama then says she can't go. She will stay with him in L.A. I don't think she's happy about this. But what can a single mother of four children do in Mexico? A woman sick all the time with factory work for skills in a land where work is mainly with the soil. What good is it except to starve? Está bien, Dad says as he nears my mother. We will make it, mujer. I know it. But we have to be patient. We have to believe. Mama turns to us and announces we are not leaving. I'm just a ball, bouncing outside, bouncing inside. Whatever.
That's Luis Rodriguez reading from his memoir, Always Running. What do you think life would have been like if you had gone back to Mexico?
It's hard to imagine. I don't even have an idea. You know, I do know that it probably would have been really extremely hard. And I think that there was the suffering that we had in this country also was an opportunity that I didn't have in Mexico. The chance for me, for example, to eventually be a writer, to be able to pursue something like that, a passion. I just know too many people who are very poor countries who don't have a chance to go towards their passions and their dreams and their hopes because they just have to survive any way they can. And even though we were in that survival mode somewhere along the line, I learned that I would have to find my particular calling and go somewhere with it.
Did you choose to join a gang or did you drift into it?
Well, you know, I think it was a combination of both. I don't think that anybody recruited me without me actually wanting to be in a gang. But there's something about when you're in an environment in which you feel that there's not any options, that you're closed off, that people don't seem to care for you in the schools, you're having problems at home, that a gang becomes very attractive. They're very cohesive. They're very tough. People tend to respect them, even if they're scared of them. Something in my small, young person mind felt that this was something that I wanted. I wanted to have that power, whatever it was they had. I wanted that power.
At that time, did you think much about the negative things that gangs do?
I didn't think about them at all. And I guess what happens is that's something that happens gradually. You start realizing, first of all, you're in there because they're your friends, your homies. These are tough guys. They have a stylized way of dressing and talking, and you're totally into that life. And then pretty soon, little things start happening. You start breaking into places. You start stealing. Now, I started stealing on my own since I was 7 years old. So it kind of, that worked in where, okay, now here's an organized way of doing it. Homies together, we would burglarize homes. Pretty soon I'm doing crimes. And it didn't quite hit me that that's not why I wanted to be in the gang, but it just became so natural part of the gang that I just fell into what was seemed natural.
When you look back to those days now, how do you feel about the Luis Rodriguez who is a gang member?
Well, you know, it's very hard to reconcile the person I am now with that person then. I was a very broken down, shy kid. I was a bully. I was somebody who was willing to risk my life and other people's lives. I was somebody who was willing to steal and not think about without consequences. It's hard to imagine that we are the same people. And I think that party that says that there's a possibility, and I think everybody, to really change with the right kind of mentorship, community, who knows, a connection to your own art, your own whatever it is, there's a possibility for people to live that kind of life and even be very destructive because I was arrested for attempted murder, I was using heroin, just things that people would think, well, write this guy off. But still, there was a thread that I could follow that could eventually lead to a point where I could be healthy, I could be sober, and I can be an artist and a member of the community that can contribute something valuable.
Who showed you that other way of living when you were in the gang?
You know, I had a couple of mentors, and this is rare because most people gave up on us. But, you know, you have that one teacher, you know, I'm talking about that. She sees something in you. I had a homeschool coordinator who was the woman that was trying to deal with the community as well as the school, very similar to the parent-teacher home visit project here in Sacramento. And then I had this one youth counselor who just saw leadership in me, and I didn't think I had leadership. I didn't even want to be a leader, but he saw something in me, and he kept fighting for me, giving me ideas, giving me options, saying, go this way. I was painting big graffiti pieces, and he told me, why don't you learn to paint murals? And he helped me get there. He got me back into high school. So there was people like that. There weren't that many. Two or three people who just kind of kept hanging in there for me.
Were you still in a gang when you started writing?
Yeah, I was like around 15 years old, sitting in jail, and I started to write. And it's kind of funny because even though I got out of jail and I ended up being stayed with the gang, I kept writing on my own. I had an old beat up typewriter, and I just kept writing and writing on my own, even though I was also on the street.
What did you start writing?
Just little vignettes, like reflections of my life. It was kind of like my own painful recollections. I had lost a friend when I was 10 years old. We had broken into a school, and he fell trying to escape from the cops. He fell down the skylight and killed himself. And I was just writing about all these things that was happening, people that were dying. It's just everything that a lot of people don't get a chance to express. For some reason, I found it in these words.
Were they poems?
I would say they were poems, but I didn't know they were poems. I didn't know what they were. Years later, when I started learning about poetry, I realized, well, these were seeds that were going to be poems.
Did you hide these poems, these writings from your homies?
No, I didn't. You know, it was kind of funny. I was the kind of kid, I loved to read, by the way. And I think that was also very helpful. And I didn't care. My homies used to make fun of me, but I was a tough guy. I can beat them all up. And it was like, but I just loved to go to the libraries, and nobody would actually go with me. It's just something that I loved to do, and I didn't mind. So it never was a thing where, okay, you're reading, you're a poet, what's wrong with you? It was more like, this is his thing. And after a while, people kind of, they respected me for it. I don't think anybody actually said, man, you're no good. Get out of here for being a poet. I think what really got people pissed off in my neighborhood was the fact that I eventually went against the gang warfare. That's what got people angry, that I would turn against the gang warfare, that I wanted to put a stop to it. I tried to do some truthing. I tried to help. And that's what got just a handful of my homeboys angry that I would challenge them on that. That got them more upset than all the whatever poetry and a mural painting I was doing, that some of them just said, hey, that's cool. You're doing that, you know.
Are they still upset?
No. It's kind of many years, 30 years later, but I have gone back to the neighborhood. I've actually talked to guys from the old days who are now in prison. The general response I get from people is, you know what, good for you that you got out, good for you that you're helping kids. Many of them feel that they're not going to be able to get out. Somebody had to get out and do something. You know, nobody has achieved much from that neighborhood, and they figure I might as well be. As long as I am honest and as long as I don't walk, do something on the side, they're always looking to see that somebody's actually to their word. And I said, I'm not going to do this criminal life no more. I'm not going to do the gang warfare. And as long as I stay true to that, I think I get the respect that, you know.
I was looking at your schedule. You got the event tonight in Sacramento, Parent-Teacher Home Visit Project. But on October 4th in Chicago, where you live now, you're training staff and students at the Cook County Juvenile Detention Center. Yeah. What do you tell the kids there?
I try to tell them about the dreams that they have lost, the importance of finding their art, the importance of finding some help, of knowing that, in fact, that they have an important mythological, spiritual, metaphorical life that they need to lead. I really get into some issues that hardly anybody gets into. It's not just mentoring, like, you know, be a good kid and get your work done and you'll be okay. It's about something deeper. What actually is their purpose? What is, it's kind of like more about soul work, more about what their particular innate gifts might be. And this is a different way of approaching it. And I think it works because hardly anybody talks to these kids like that. So they're almost just there just because nobody's ever told them something like that.
Do you tell them about your own youth so that they understand where you come from?
I think I have to. And I think that's what really opens them up to my story. When they know about what I went through, stealing at 7 years old, in and out of jails, the drug addictions, the shootings that I got involved in, then they see, well, that's what I'm going through. Hey, okay. So they can see that's me. But then what they don't always see is what I was able to prove, that I could find a way out of this. And that's helpful, I think, if they know that I'm in the same place they were in or they're in now. And then maybe there's a light that they can go towards that could help them get through this.
And finally, Luis, if you could sit down with the president, the governor, any civic leaders, mayors, and so on, what's the most important thing that political leaders need to know to help improve the life and the prospects of people living in places like East LA?
I think we can't afford to abandon these kids. As rough as they are, as mean, as ugly, some things they can do. I was a really bad kid. Most people walked away from me. I totally understand it. My own mother threw me out of the house. She was a good mom. She threw me out of the house. I just don't think they could be abandoned. I think there's ways to approach them. I think we need more imagination, more outlets, more things for kids to do. We just got to be there for them until they finally find their own traction and their own legs and they start taking their lives on themselves.
That's writer Luis J. Rodriguez. He's in Sacramento for a talk this evening at the Parent Teacher Home Visit Project, a local nonprofit that aims to build more trust and respect between parents and school staff. Luis, thanks so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer was Rob Whitlock. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us.